Bonjour à tous. Je ne vais pas être trop près du micro. Je vous remercie beaucoup de vous retrouver ici donc, pour le séminaire du professeur Walter Gehring, donc, qui est au Biozentrum à Basel, en Suisse, qui est quelqu'un d'extrêmement connu, mondialement célèbre. En fait, il est à l'origine et son groupe de la découverte des gènes OX, hein, il y a quelques années. De ses élèves ont eu le prix Nobel de physiologie et de médecine en 1995. Walter a eu tous les prix possibles et imaginables sur la planète. Et il va nous parler d'un thème qui l'intéresse beaucoup, qui est l'origine de la vision. En fait, tout va démarrer à partir d'observations. Alors, Walter a travaillé en Suisse, il a fait sa thèse sur des oiseaux, il est aussi un très grand naturaliste, c'est ce que j'aime chez lui. C'est rare des chercheurs de ce niveau en biologie moléculaire qui sont aussi des naturalistes. D'ailleurs, on est en train de déplorer tous les deux qu'ils disparaissent plus vite que tout ce qui disparaît sur cette planète. Et Walter fait sa thèse donc, sur les oiseaux grâce au radar de l'aéroport de Zurich, il y a quelques années déjà. Et ensuite, donc, il passe sur le modèle drosophile, hein, sur la mouche, et il va faire des choses extraordinaires. C'est un des plus grands drosophilistes de la planète. Et d'ailleurs, je m'amuse souvent avec les gens qui font la drosophile en disant « Vous êtes entomologiste, il ne sait pas ce que ça veut dire. » Mais Walter, il sait ce que ça veut dire, l'entomologie, pour un drosophiliste. Et donc, il mettra la main sur quelque chose d'extraordinaire dans les années 90. C'est le fait que chez les invertébrés, chez la mouche en l'occurrence à l'époque, et chez des souris, dans le laboratoire aux États-Unis, il démontre en fait que la mise en place de l'œil se fait grâce à une séquence génique qu'ils vont appeler effectivement PAX6. Hein. Il va vous en parler. Et Walter montrera justement que la même séquence met en place des yeux chez énormément d'espèces, des invertébrés et aussi des vertébrés. Je ne vais pas déflorer le sujet, je vais le laisser en parler. Simplement, quand il va à Héraclion, en 94, au colloque mondial sur la drosophile, en Crète, il dira, voilà, nous pensons effectivement que la même séquence de gènes met en place les yeux chez la mouche et chez la souris. Alors que des tas de papiers dans les meilleures revues du monde avaient déjà dit, c'est pas possible, de toute façon, on avait au moins 60 lignées différentes pour expliquer la mise en place des yeux. Et tout le monde rigole, et c'est là la différence entre un chercheur de son niveau et un chercheur normal. Il va rentrer furieux dans son labo et dit à ses thésards le soir, on ne dort plus, on va surexprimer PAX6, on va l'invalider, et on verra ce qu'on verra. Quelques semaines après, ils font la une de tous les grands journaux de la planète, le New York Times, Die Zeit, Le Monde, où justement ils montrent ces yeux ectopiques hein, produits sur différents tissus, organes, chez la mouche. Et vous verrez, c'est une merveilleuse histoire très évolutive, ça tombe bien par rapport à ma conférence d'aujourd'hui, qui sera dédiée justement à la santé, et puis à la ville, où en fait, quelques modèles comme ça, vraiment emblématiques, qu'on connaît vraiment parfaitement, nous permettent de comprendre des choses qui sont vraiment universelles, et c'est tout l'aspect merveilleux, bien sûr, du vivant. Voilà, je vais placer la parole maintenant à Walter. Voilà, merci Walter.
Merci Gilles. Je prendrai ce micro-là.
Okay. Alors, juste une petite précision, donc Walter va parler en anglais, mais il comprend très bien le français. Donc si vous voulez le questionner en français, après vous pourrez le faire. Alors on va faire comme la dernière fois, ça veut dire que comme on est un peu limité par le temps, il va s'arrêter à moins 5, pour que je puisse moi démarrer à l'heure, à 11h. Et si vous voulez à midi 5, quand je terminerai, vous pourrez poser quelques questions si vous voulez, y compris en français si vous voulez. Voilà, c'est à toi Walter, merci.
Merci. Alors... I show you first here a picture of Charles Darwin. This is a relief which Hubertus von Pilgrim, mon ami sculpteur, has done. And it celebrates the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin, which is important. Here it shows Darwin with a pigeon. And this is no accident. The weakness of Charles Darwin's theory was that he didn't understand genetics. Gregor Mendel sent him his paper around 1860 or so, but Darwin probably never read it. And so he didn't understand genetics, but he knew that he should understand genetics. And he was starting to breed pigeons because pigeon breeders had initiated breeding programs and shown that by artificial selection you could get all sorts of pigeons, various variants, but the mechanism was not understood. And for a long time, though, it was thought that Darwin's theory was correct if interpreted in modern genetic terms. And today I'd like to show you that all the ifs and buts which the creationists have put forward against Darwin are not valuable. First of all, we now have direct evidence that selection works in bacterial cultures. This is an experiment which was done by Naswal and Andersons, and it shows that you can select for a new gene in the course of about 3,000 bacterial generations if you do it appropriately. So 3,000 generations in human terms would mean 75,000 years. So in 75,000 years, you can observe a new gene arising. And what they have done here, they took an enzyme which is involved in histidine biosynthesis and is an isomerase which converts this compound into this compound. This enzyme has a little bit of activity also in tryptophan biosynthesis, but really marginal. So what they did, they started with this enzyme, which is strong in histidine biosynthesis and very weak in tryptophan, and asked, can we now evolve a tryptophan enzyme? And in fact, within 3,000 generations, this was possible. So you can observe evolution in real time. You can see evolution and you can see the effect of selection. So, and what they have done here is to start 500 generations, 1,000 generations, and then split into 8 cultures. And then what you see here is basically a Darwinian pedigree. You see that among the first thing which happens, actually, and that's always the case, that's the only thing which you can predict in evolution. Evolution is absolutely unpredictable. That's what Jacques Monod already said. And you see it here, too. But the first thing which happens for these bacteria to survive, I have to say, they were now raised in the absence of both histidine and tryptophan. So there was a strong selective pressure to synthesize both histidine and tryptophan. And what happens first is that you get a gene duplication. That means your poor enzyme, which makes only a little bit of tryptophan, now is duplicated. That means it makes twice as much, okay? And so you have twice as much enzyme, but then from then on, nothing is predictable. And what happens then is that you can have an enzyme which is specific for histidine, and this second, the duplicate, evolves into an enzyme which codes for tryptophan. And this is due to several point mutations. And these point mutations are absolutely unpredictable. And when you split into 8 lineages, you see here the outcome is very different. First of all, there are lines which die out. That's also known from Darwin. Darwin assumed that certain species or subspecies die out. And then you have some which make 2 enzymes and some which make only 1 enzyme, but this enzyme now is active for both, for histidine and for tryptophan. Or you can make 2 enzymes, and here you have the point mutations. They're always different in the different lines. Here is another one which dies out, etc. So the point mutations are absolutely unpredictable. The duplication forms the basis for making a new gene. You duplicate the old gene, and then the old gene can take over a new function. And that's very strong evidence for, that's in fact proof for Darwin's theory. Okay, they haven't done one control. I called him up and said, what happens in the absence of selection? The neutral theory of evolution. And he said, I know, it's underway. So he still has to do that experiment. Now, if you don't believe in bacteria and you are a fan of birds like myself, I can show you the same thing in birds, namely the Grants, Elizabeth and Pete the Grant. They have their own Galapagos Islands, their own island on which they know every bird. And one year there was an El Nino situation, and there was a tremendous drought. And so many of the plants died out because of dryness, and only those plants which make very hard seeds with hard shells survived. And that had a tremendous consequence for the Darwin finches, because Darwin finches originally were insectivores. You see here the most primitive form of the Darwin finch, which is an insectivore. I took that picture myself. I'm quite proud of that. And then, after the drought, only those survived which had very strong beaks and could crack open the hard seeds. And here you see the substantial beak here. And that was observed within a few years. So you can see evolution at work, undoubtedly, in bacteria, in birds, wherever you want. There was another objection which the creationists had towards Darwin, and that was eye evolution. And eye evolution was a big problem for Charles Darwin, because when he wrote an early version of his book on the origin of the species, he gave a draft of the book to his wife to read. And his wife agreed to most of what he said in the book, as a good wife should, at least in the 19th century. But then when it came to eyes, she said, "This is absurd. How do you want to explain an eagle's eye with random variation and selection?" So he was in big trouble. But then, and he wrote an entire chapter in The Origin of Species on the difficulties of his theory. So it's a very honest book, you see. An entire chapter on difficulties. You show me that other book which has that. It's very rare, very rare. But and there the eyes figure prominently. And first he repeats his wife's sentence. "It seems absurd that an eye could possibly evolve by random variation and selection." He didn't know about mutation, but random variation, that's what he proposed. And then he finds a way out of that. He says, if there had been ever in evolution a very primitive prototype, which would consist just of two cells, a pigment cell and a photoreceptor cell, which he calls a nerve. Nerves were not known to be cells at that time. That was before Cajal. A pigment cell and a nerve, then the animal could see with this kind of prototypic eye, and it could have directional vision, because the pigment cell shields the light from one side, and therefore the animal can tell the direction of where the light comes from. And that's a big selective advantage. And then he says, once you have that, then you could evolve all these fancy cell types which we have now. And the neo-Darwinist didn't really read his book carefully enough, because he says, "I cannot explain the prototype by selection, because selection can only work once you see a little bit, once the function is there to some extent, and then the selection can improve and improve it." But the neo-Darwinists assumed that the eye arose 40 to 60 times. And this would have sacked Darwin's theory, actually. They weren't aware of that. But in my doctoral exam, I had to repeat this, okay? This was the standard notion for 100 years, that the eye has evolved 40 to 60 times independently. And then I have to prove myself wrong. First of all, the Japanese workers found a planarian, a flatworm, which has such prototypic eyes, consisting just of a pigment cell and a photoreceptor cell with an axon which goes to the brain here. And so that existed. Darwin didn't know that. And then from that you could explain how these wonderful cell types arise. You have the camera type eye in vertebrates, the camera type eye in squids and octopuses, the insect compound eye, which looks so completely differently and develops so completely differently. How could there be an underlying mechanism in common? Well, I showed that later on. And eyes are, and then here you have mirror eyes. These are scallops. And if you didn't know that scallops have eyes, next time you eat coquille Saint-Jacques, please look at their eyes. And here I show you that the eyes are very old. They go back to Cambrian times. Here you have the trilobite phacops, for example. Okay. Now, the thing started with the finding of a mutant. The mutant was first found in mice. It's called small eye because in heterozygous embryos you find a small eye. The homozygous embryo has no eyes at all. It's eyeless. Also, it's noseless, and it has a large part of the brain missing. You can see the shape of the head is abnormal here. And this turns out to be a mutation which in Drosophila was discovered much earlier, but not isolated by cloning. So my graduate student, Rebecca Quiring, isolated the gene by a pure accident, a lucky accident. And she found that the homologue of the small eye mutation is eyeless in Drosophila. And that gave me numerous sleepless nights. How could it be that you have the same gene blocking eye development in mice as in flies? And then it dawned on me, maybe this is the master control gene for forming eyes, which is found in mammals and in insects at the same time. Now everybody thought Walter has turned crazy now. How can it be so simple that a single gene induces an eye which consists, which involves thousands of genes to make an eye? And how could it be so simple? But I wanted my theory to be tested, so I hired these two guys, or I recruited them. I convinced them that this was a good idea. This is George Holder, a Swiss graduate student, and Patrick Kallertz, a Belgian postdoc. And what you can see here, actually, the picture was obviously taken after the experiment was successful, because we are all smiling. If you had taken the picture beforehand, you'd have seen two overworked students, tired, an angry professor because they didn't progress fast enough. But after the experiment, it looks like this. So you never take the control picture before. And what I told them to do and was the following: to take promote an enhancer, GAL4, a transcription factor from yeast, to turn on the Drosophila gene in various places, in the antennal disc, in the wing disc, in the leg disc, etc., to see whether we could induce an eye. And of course it didn't work. It didn't work for months. And one evening they were playing bridge with my friend Markus Saffolter. And he told me later on, they told him, tomorrow we have to tell Walter this is a bad idea, it doesn't work, and we have to give up. The next morning I had to bring my car to the garage, therefore I came in very late. Instead of 9 o'clock, I came at 11:30. And that gave them a chance, that rescued the whole thing. They gave them a chance to look at their flies again, and they saw the first red spots on the legs. So they pulled me to the microscope and asked, is this eye pigment? Since I have seen in my life about 10 to the 10 flies, I know exactly how Drosophila eye pigment red looks. And so I told them, yes, this is eye pigment, but I don't want just to see eye pigment. I want to see eyes. Back to the bench and do some more experiments. Well, what was the secret? You have to turn on the PAX6 gene early enough before the decision is made to make a leg or an eye or a wing or an eye. And when you do that, then you get these beautiful antennalized or eyes on the legs. And this one was actually, we later found out there are actually two PAX6 genes in Drosophila, only one in humans and in mice. And therefore, we could try both, and they both work in making these wonderful eyes. Here is one on the wing. Look at this huge compound eye on the wing. And we later also showed that these eyes are functional, so they can see with these eyes. So now we worked out the regulatory scheme for eye development, and eyelids and twin of eyelids are on top of the hierarchy. And then they activate sinoculis here, optics here, etc. And these are all transcription factors. So the gene regulatory proteins, they switch on the genetic program. It's like a computer program. You put in PowerPoint, and then it starts the whole cascade, and all the 1,000 genes which are necessary for eye formation are successively turned on. We have determined those. At the larval stage, there are about 100 genes needed at least, and pupil stage, 400 and 500 at the adult stage, total of about 1,000. Here you have mostly transcription factors, which turn on the program. Here you have the structural genes, which build the eye, and here you have the functional genes like rhodopsin, arrestin, etc., which are involved in vision. So we have deciphered the entire program. We would like to compare that with the mouse, because the mouse eye looks very different, but shares the key regulators, which are in common. So we have found this PAX6 gene now all over the pedigree, from planarians to C. elegans to sea squirts, Drosophila, squid, ribbon worm, sea urchin, Amphioxus, fish, amphibians, birds, mammals. So this is a good zoological pedigree, and the gene is all over the place. And so now our theory confirms Darwin absolutely. You first have to evolve things like rhodopsin, then you have to make pigment, and then you make a pigment cell in black. This is the transcription factor, MITF. PAX6 is the one which makes the photoreceptor cells, and then from this prototype you get radiation to all of these wonderful cell types. Now, dream experiment number two of mine, sleepless night, was to take the mouse gene and stick it into Drosophila, and it works wonderfully well. This is induced by the mouse gene. So flies can understand mice, but of course this is a Drosophila eye and not a mouse eye. One of my colleagues thought and published that this is a mouse eye. Now, not even Walter Gehring can do that, because you would need 1,000 genes to make a mouse eye different. This is only the main switch which is changed. It starts the cascade, and then a Drosophila eye is made on the antenna here. And I'm very proud to say Ernst Mayr, the major representative of the neo-Darwinists, said the origin of eyes in 40 branches of the evolutionary tree was always considered to be convergent development. Molecular biology, that means Walter Gehring, has now shown that this is not entirely correct. I would say totally wrong, but he admits it's not entirely correct. Okay. And now I want to trace back for the last 10 years I've been working on this now, tracing back all the way to the origin of vision. And the first organisms which have vision are cyanobacteria. Cyanobacteria have chlorophyll. They can photosynthesize. So it's a big advantage if you are a photosynthetic organism to find the light, because you need the light to make photosynthesis. And these organisms already have invented rhodopsin, a primitive form of rhodopsin, and they are phototactic, that is, they can swim towards the light, and some of them are multicellular. They have even invented cell differentiation. You see these heterocysts here. These are the photosynthetic cells. These are nitrogen fixating cells. So the same organism can fix nitrogen and carbon, okay? That's a big selective advantage. And so these were very successful. So it all starts with these. And they already have eye spots. An Italian has found that, and it wasn't known to me, but a Japanese friend told me about this. They have an eye in front of the cell. They have long, slender cells, and if you make an EM section, so this is an eye spot. In here are carotene granules, as you find them in all eye spots. I'll show you more later on. And in the membrane, there is this bacterial rhodopsin, which is involved in vision. Now, cyanobacteria are among the oldest fossils known in the world. They are 3.5 billion years old. They're called stromatolites. What you see here are layers and layers of cyanobacteria. And I went especially to Western Australia to see those. These are called stromatolites. They are 3,500 million years old. And animals are only 500 million years old. So they had 3 billion years to diverge. And nowadays, you can still see stromatolites in the lagoons of Western Australia. I went there. This is Shark's Bay. And here you see these bumps. And there are little mountains all formed by millions of cyanobacteria. And they have invented rhodopsin. Rhodopsin was invented before by the salt bacteria, but later on it was it's found in cyanobacteria, like Anabaena here. And what they do is they transmit the light signal to histidine kinase, and the histidine kinase phosphorylates a regulatory protein, and the regulatory protein signals directly to the flagellar motor. So these cells are motile, they have a flagellum, and they can steer the flagellum via this motor. And therefore, this is a very basic invention. It's always 7 transmembrane domains in that molecule, and this is retinal. And retinal is in all transform, and then when a light photon hits it, it turns into an 11 cis form. The same as in humans, but we do the inverse reaction. And when you look at these primitive rhodopsins, and you do an unrooted tree, evolutionary tree, you find the following. You find that all the archaeal, the salt bacterial rhodopsin, so are clustered here in violet. The green algal channelopsins are here. This is Chlamydomonas volvox. And then the cyanobacteria are split. One is over here, and one is over here. And that's the sign of horizontal gene transfer. These are all related to one another, derived from one another. But these have gotten the gene from their neighbors here in the cluster. And here is the interesting cluster. Gleobacter is very close to 3 dinoflagellates. And dinoflagellates will now become the major subject. When you do a normal pedigree of the higher organism opsins, you find various types. The one in jellyfish, the ones in jellyfish are grouped here. The ciliary opsin family is here. The rhabdomeric is here. And this is what we consider a normal pedigree due to vertical inheritance. But actually, the pedigrees are much more complicated if you go back to bacteria, because bacteria horizontally exchange genes from one species to another. So you have a mess here. And two major influxes are occurring to the animals, the plants and the fungi. And these are the mitochondria. There was a bacterium which was incorporated into a eukaryotic cell and gave rise to the mitochondria, which are involved in respiration. Another bacterium, and this was a cyanobacterium, of course, gave rise to chloroplasts. And the chloroplasts then go to algae and to plants. Now, when you look in Chlamydomonas, green algae, single cell, where is the eye spot? It's in the chloroplast. That is, it's derived from cyanobacteria. You have the carotene granules back here. You have the rhodopsin molecules in the cellular membrane here. They're hit by light. The channel opens, and sodium and calcium flows in and then triggers the light reaction, and there is a signal to the cilium to orient the swimming of the Chlamydomonas cell. If you look in multicellular algae, this is Volvox sphere consisting of individual flagellates here. And you see again the pigment granules here. The eye spot is in the chloroplast. That is, the eye originates from cyanobacteria. And then, if you go, and that is a model which was not developed by myself, but which is the basis for my model. And that says that originally there was a cyanobacterium which was engulfed by a red alga. And you have a primary chloroplast here with an outer cyanobacterial and an inner cyanobacterial membrane. Then this whole red construct was taken up by the yellow cell, a second eukaryote. So you have now two nuclei and one chloroplast. And the chloroplast ideally has four membranes, the two bacterial ones, the green ones, the red one, and the yellow one. In the case of dinoflagellates, one of them was lost, but there are still three, which means this is a secondary chloroplast. Originally, it was sitting in a red alga. Now, why do I insist on dinoflagellates? Because dinoflagellates have invented an eye in a single cell. Look, this is like a human eye. This has a cornea, this has a lens, a pigment cup, and the same thing here in a different species. And these cells are heavily phototactic. So I put my dish, a culture dish, under the lamp. Here is the lamp. You come back 5 minutes later. What happens? All the cells have accumulated in this corner. No doubt that they are phototactic. Okay? They are attracted by the light. When you look at the section, EM section, which Jürgen Roth made for me, you see, now my dinoflagellate has taken up another, a tertiary chloroplast, which is a diatome. And you see, here is the nucleus of the cell, and here is the eye structure. And I'll show you the eye in bigger, or ocellus in bigger dimensions. Here you have again the carotene granules, which I keep showing to you. And then this sort of projects on these five lamellar bodies here. You see these beautiful stacked membranes here. And this is just like in a human eye, where you have the stacked membranes in your rods and cones. So I think the cyanobacteria have invented most everything of what we have in our eyes. So I formulated, here you have some EM section. You see the beautiful single-celled eye. But this is my next scientific life, if I have to clear this up. And then you have stacked membranes in the retina in the back of these. And we have shown that the rhodopsin is localized in here, and that the molecule are ordered almost in a semicrystalline order by polarized light, you can see by refringence. So this led me to formulate my Russian doll hypothesis. So the first Russian doll, that's the cyanobacterium. This is the red alga, and this is the dinoflagellate. Now, how did it come to humans? I think now that the fourth Russian doll will be the jellyfish, because dinoflagellates are symbionts in corals and in jellyfish. The coral bleaching, which probably she will discuss with you, the coral bleaching is due to the death of the dinoflagellates, which are symbionts. And so the corals will not survive without their symbiont. So I think I was looking for the fourth Russian doll here. And now I can present you evidence that there is a fourth Russian doll. Here is the jellyfish, like Clodonema. This is Hydrozoan. It has an eye on each tentacle. Why on the tentacle? We, of course, are used to having eyes on the head, because then the eye signals to the brain and from the brain to the muscle, okay? What do you do if you have no brain? Well, you put the eye directly above the muscle, okay? So that you can steer the muscle directly. And these guys are very skilled in catching little crustaceans visually. And so this is a symbiont, Symbiodinium microadriaticum. This is a symbiont in a jellyfish, in a Cassiopeia polyp. And this is a dinoflagellate, as you can see from the structure here. And now, I used to teach a marine biology course for many years in Bunyuls, where I met Jill for the first time. And I used to teach these plankton movements. During World War II, when sonar was invented, it was found that plankton goes through vertical movements. So at 5 p.m. during the day, the plankton is down here, 6 p.m., and then at sunset, they begin to move upwards and they come up at night. Now, I never understood why. But then, in reading the literature, it became clear to me what's happening. In the original atmosphere, during when life arose, there was no oxygen. There was no ozone layer, and therefore a lot of heavy UV radiation of the organisms in the ocean. So they want to get away from the UV, and what they do is simply they move down in the ocean where the UV is absorbed, and they are safe. There are three ways of avoiding the UV. What we do is we acquire a suntan, so a pigment which protects us. What these plankton organisms do, because they're colorless, they don't want to be seen by the fish and eaten by the fish, so they are transparent. They simply go down in the ocean. And the third way is to repair the damage. What's happening is if you get heavily UV irradiated, your DNA becomes cross-linked. That is, your pyrimidine base pairs or form a ring. They are fused to one another, and you have a mutation, and that's what may eventually be lethal. So you can cleave these bonds between the two dimers, and you can reconstruct the normal DNA. It's an enzyme called photolyase. Here you see the vertical migration again. They are most on the top at midnight. And here is the photolyase enzyme, which is able to to cleave two pyrimidine dimers apart. And now this is the most fascinating molecule. So as a DNA repair enzyme, it's in the nucleus, of course. But in order to cleave the UV dimers, you need energy, activation energy. And this comes from blue light. Why blue light? Well, blue goes fastest down in the ocean. So blue light activates this enzyme. Now, the enzyme turns into a blue light receptor eventually, and turns out to be the origin of cryptochrome. Cryptochrome is a blue light receptor, and photolyase is practically the same molecule. You see all the homologies in red here. And so the two molecules are practically identical. I, and you probably know, couldn't tell the difference in three-dimensional structure. This is a blue light receptor from a plant. This is bacterial photolyase, and they are basically the same thing. So this molecule has become this molecule. And actually, by a single amino acid substitution, we can reconstruct the photolyase activity. So this is quite clear. Now, it has acquired a different function. The blue light receptor now certainly becomes a transcription factor, which is involved in the internal clock of the fly here and of the mouse as well. So you have two cry genes here, which are involved in regulating the day-night cycle clock. Obviously, you need calibration by the sun in order to regulate this. And so we now have a whole family of different proteins. You have photolyases, type 1, type 2. Then you have one which splits this kind of DNA fusion, or this kind. This is the dimer. You see this ring of four carbons here that has to be cleaved by the photolyases. And then by adding this red piece here, you come to a blue light receptor, and Drosophila and humans have that too. So where did that come from? And this is where it becomes interesting. Now, if you do a pedigree, you have the type 1 photolyases. These are the original bacterial ones. There are two kinds of cofactors. There is desoxyacetylene or pyridine cofactor. Then you have the 6-4 cleaving enzymes. And you have the animal cryptochromes, blue light receptors, and transcription factors, and the plant blue light receptors here in this pedigree. And when you now make a larger pedigree, and that I did beforehand, it's quite surprising, because you find here the primitive kind are all bacteria, mostly cyanobacteria. Then you come to the plant blue light receptor, you have Chlamydomonas, you have Arabidopsis. And now it becomes interesting. Here you have the animal cryptochromes and the plant 6-4 photolyases. And what you see here is that flies, this is an alga, this is a cyanobacterium, extremely close to the fly. And here is another fly gene. Here is two human genes, the two human cryptochromes. They're all in one pot here. And now the question is, where the dinoflagellates, the mediator of this gene transfer? I skip, and that I skip too. Now, how do you find out about horizontal gene transfer versus vertical normal inherited gene transfer? And this is a pedigree based on ribosomal RNA. You don't have to see the details, but here are all the eukaryotes, organisms with a nucleus, and here are all the bacteria, and here are all the archaea, which are the sister group of the bacteria. And what you see here very clearly, there's a large distance between the eukaryotes, which are about 500 million years old, and the archaea, which are about 3.5 billion years old. So there are 3 billion years in between here for which to diverge. Now, the question is, can we at least deduce something from these pedigrees if there is also horizontal gene transfer? And that was possible by doing that same pedigree, shown here on the left with the large distance, for the whole genomes. And what you see here now, that the whole thing is coming much more close, because there was horizontal gene transfer. But still, the groups are nicely separate. Here the archaea, the eukaryotes, the proteobacteria. So you can deduce something, but it's more confusing. So they're closer to one another. So what we did now was to take genes which are horizontally transferred, or vertically transferred, and these are, for example, the ribosomal genes. The ribosomal genes are very highly, protein genes are very highly conserved, not only in sequence, but also in the order on which they are ordered along the chromosome. You see these blue and white yellows are nicely ordered. The yellow ones are from the large subunit, and the blue are from the blue subunit. So these are clearly very conserved in evolution, all the way from archaea to cyanobacteria to Bacillus subtilis. Okay. So we took one of these genes and followed it all the way to humans. Okay, and what you find then is the following. You have the two cyanobacteria up here, Cleobacter and Nostoc, and all the eukaryotes are down here in a cluster with a huge distance in between, okay? Now we take another one. Here is another one, Nostoc, Cleobacter. Here are our friends up here, including now our dinoflagellate. Again, you take protein L4, the cyanobacteria are way, way different. And EF1-alpha, an elongation factor, the two cyanobacteria out here. Now the dinoflagellate is quite some distance from the human and so on. And now we come to cryptochromes. And here you have it. Look how the cryptochrome is clustered. You see now the Drosophila gene is two Drosophila genes here, a cyanobacterial gene, the dinoflagellate, and the human gene. Okay? They're all clustered. That means there was horizontal transfer first from the cyanobacterium to the dinoflagellate and then to animals. And the evidence for that is very strong. Now we have done all the various cryptochromes from the dinoflagellate. Here is class one. Here is the cryptochrome, the dash cryptochrome. Here, this one was not labeled, was cut off from the slide. Here is another dinoflagellate one. And you always have them clustered, the dinoflagellate, the Drosophila, the human and mouse are always very strongly clustered. So the blue light receptor, which we have, which we use to calibrate our clock, which we have up here in the epiphysis, comes all the way back from cyanobacteria, red alga, dinoflagellate, jellyfish, and then vertically up to humans. So I can safely add now the fourth Russian doll, and that's the jellyfish. Thank you very much.